This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
For this month's Ask an Astronomer, we are joined by Professor Tim O'Brien. I get the impression that Tim is one of the busiest people on the planet right now, so I'm very grateful that he's been able to join us. Charlie tells me it's been about 2 years since you were last on the Jodcast.
We did look it up. It was January 2014.
January 2014. So what have you been up to since then?
I think I got busy because I started spending half my time being an associate dean, which is a sort of administrative job in the faculty. So 50% of the time I was doing that, plus the other 150% of my time I was doing other things. So yeah, I think I fell off the Jodcast wagon.
Yeah.
But I'm getting back on, so that's good.
Okay, I've actually heard you in the media quite a lot recently, chatting about Blue Dot Festival.
Blue Dot's going to be great, I think. It's a music and science festival at Jodrell Bank at the end of July, so still tickets available if anybody's interested in buying one. If you look at discovertheBlueDot.com, you'll find all the information. But it's basically building on some things we did back in 2011 to 2013, where we had music festivals at Jodrell. So bands like Elbow and Sigur Rós and New Order and these sorts of people. And then alongside music, we had some sort of science festival as well. But what we're doing this time is running it as a full sort of camping festival over the weekend. So this year we've got Jean-Michel Jarre, if you've heard of Jean-Michel Jarre.
I absolutely have done, yeah.
So he's playing on the Saturday, and we've got Underworld, who are quite an interesting electronic band, Caribou as well, Public Service Broadcasting. Got Brian Cox and Robin Ince doing a recording of their Infinite Monkey Cage. Loads of stuff, so loads of science, loads of art and technology as well as the music, so it should be great fun.
So there's no excuse really for any listeners not to go to this.
I think if you're the sort of person who listens to the Jodcast, you're the sort of person who ought to go to Blue Dot.
Excellent. So what was the website for that again?
It's discovertheBlueDot.com.
Okay.
And I should say Blue Dot in case you haven't picked it up. Is a nod to Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot.
Yes.
So the sort of the planet Earth in space as a seen from a distance as a little blue dot. So it's all basically about, you know, space and also what we do on the planet. So sort of human creativity, really, as well as science, music, art and so on.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that. So let's have a look at the questions. So, as ever, we have three listener-submitted questions. Our first one is from Christoph Cranbull, who asks, what single space mission would you launch in the next 10 years if money was no constraint?
I think that was a challenging question, but I thought it was fun anyway. I think actually having constraints is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because actually, usually drives a bit of creativity, actually. If somebody said to you, money's no object, what would you do? Because anything's possible, it's almost impossible to decide what you want. So it's almost a good idea to have sort of a, you know, budget, and then you can achieve the maximum you can by being sort of creative. But in these terms, I guess, one of the things we'd always fancy doing, certainly speaking from a radio astronomy background, if we were thinking about, say, doing radio astronomy from space, then I think the idea of building a radio telescope on the far side of the moon would be a nice thing. So you basically block the radio interference of the Earth is blocked by the moon. It's very quiet. That's always a challenge for us in radio astronomy is all the interference we get terrestrially. Low gravity, so you could build it really big because the structure would be easy to build a large structure. No wind. That's the other problem that, you know, we have in radio astronomy is wind might blow our big telescopes down. So there's loads of reasons why you'd want to do that. I think a space-based interferometer would be good. I mean, maybe, you know, there is a plan actually to do this in the future with sort of space-based LIGO, so the interferometer that was used to detect gravitational waves recently. Putting one of those in space would be a remarkable thing to be able to do. There's a mission at the moment that's trying to test out the technology for that called LISA Pathfinder, and I think that will happen. But if money was no object, then maybe it would happen a bit quicker.
Yeah.
Not always, because you've got to get the people to do the actual work, and just throwing more money at something doesn't obviously solve anything. Stuff to search for life, I guess. Searching for life in the solar system, maybe on Enceladus or Europa, one of these moons of the giant planets. That would be an interesting project as well, I think. So something like that, probably.
Of course, you could also add a little bit of funding for the Jodcast if money was no constraint as well.
Just a bit.
Our next question is from Russ Jenkins. Why do they always say microgravity when they talk about life on the space station? Surely there is pretty much normal gravity, not much less than 1G up there, except that it doesn't feel like that as the station is in orbit. Doesn't that mean that the perceived gravity is neutral? Probably means zero.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. You do hear people will talk about microgravity on the space station. What I wanted to do was try and do some maths on the radio, or maths on the Jodcast.
That's quite risky.
If we can attempt to do this, but it sort of might illustrate the point. So the space station's at an altitude of about 400 kilometres above the Earth's surface. The Earth's radius is almost 6,400 kilometres. So you're basically talking about the difference between something on the Earth being at 6,400 kilometres from the middle of the Earth and something like the space station being 6,800 kilometres from the middle. So there's actually not a lot of difference in terms of the gravity you feel. So in fact, you can sort of work that out. We know that the acceleration due to gravity that's felt by something that's, say, 1 kilogram mass, that's given by gm over r squared, where m is the mass of the Earth, r is the radius from the centre of the Earth. So you put in the mass of the Earth, you put in the radius of the Earth at the Earth's surface, and what you get is an acceleration due to gravity of 9.8 metres per second per second. That's the classic answer for the acceleration due to gravity. So if you drop something at the Earth's surface, that's the acceleration you get. If you put the same numbers in for the height of the space station, so the radius is slightly larger by 400 kilometres, you get 8.7 metres per second squared. So about 90% of the value at the Earth's surface. So it is a lower gravity at the height of the space station, but not by much.
Yeah.
So the question was, you know, what's microgravity, what's zero gravity? Well, although that's the pull of gravity, about 90% of what you feel at the Earth's surface while we're talking now, 90% of that is what you get in the space station. The space station's in orbit, so the space station's actually falling. If you were to sort of hold the space station still above the Earth and let go of it, it would drop down towards the Earth, of course. It would be pulled towards the centre of the Earth. If you move it sideways, it still falls, but it misses the edge of the Earth because the Earth goes around. So it continually goes round and round, missing the Earth as it falls. That's all an orbit is. So it's free fall. But that would be sort of zero gravity because it's a bit like, and I know this is a horrible thing to imagine, but it's a bit like getting in the lift and the lift cable's snapping and you dropping in the lift. You'd be in free fall. So you can imagine sort of floating, it was a very high tower, floating inside this lift in the middle, and the lift and you would both be accelerating downwards at the same rate. So that's that sort of free fall. That would be zero gravity. So the question that Russ asked was, why do we not talk about zero gravity? Why do we talk about microgravity since it's in this sort of free fall orbit? And actually, the reasons that I think, you know, they're quite interesting. One is that the space station, you know, you've seen pictures of Tim Peake or something on the space station and they're taking lovely photographs of the Earth out the window. There's windows that sort of look down at the Earth. And they stay pointing down at the Earth all the time as the space station rotates. So if you can imagine that, that actually means the space station is itself rotating at exactly the same rate at which it moves around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not sort of standing still in space as it orbits, because that would mean the windows would go from looking down at the Earth to looking directly away and then back again over one orbit. So the orbit's about 90 minutes. So actually the space station rotates with a period of about 90 minutes. Now, you know that if you were to sort of, you know, go on a fairground ride or a roundabout or something and you spin that roundabout, you get sort of, you feel this effective acceleration that flings you outwards from this rotating thing.
Yeah.
So the fact that the space station's rotating means that there's an effective acceleration felt that pushes you away from the centre of the space station. And you can actually work that out. And again, let's do a little bit of maths on the podcast. Let's attempt it anyway. For sort of circular motion, if you imagine sort of something rotating in a, you know, in a circular, around a circular path, then the acceleration that you feel is given by V squared over R. So V is the velocity or the speed at which you're moving, and R is the distance from the centre of rotation. So you can actually put into that equation, you can put in the fact that the period of this rotation for the space station is, say, 90 minutes, how long it takes to go around the Earth. So that basically tells you what the speed is, because it'd be 2 pi r would be the path of this thing divided by the period, 90 minutes. And that gives you an expression for the speed, which you can then put into that equation for the acceleration of v squared over r. And what you actually find is an acceleration of 1 micro g, so 1 millionth of the gravity at the surface of the Earth, you would actually find that acceleration would be at a distance of 7 meters from the centre of the space station.
Hmm.
If you work that equation out, which is quite interesting.
That is so interesting. Actually,
you only have to be the space station itself is maybe 100 meters across. So if you're 7 meters away from the sort of centre of rotation of that space station, you would feel this acceleration of 1 millionth of a g, which is a microgravity.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why we don't talk about zero g. There are other reasons. Basically, it feels drag, so it's not as if there's space is a complete vacuum. At 400 kilometres, you've even got some residual atmosphere, but you've also got the interplanetary medium and so on. So the space station feels drag, and that would be felt as an acceleration on the space station. It has to boost its orbit occasionally because that drag can result in it changing its orbital radius, and it might have to accelerate in some way to adjust its orbit, so you'd feel that. And even the fact that at 100 metres across, the force of gravity you feel from the surface of the Earth changes over the size of the space station, because you know, one at the far side of the space station, you're slightly farther away from the Earth. So I think all those reasons combined mean that you never quite get zero G, and you do get about, you know, millionths of a little G, which is the acceleration of gravity at the Earth's surface.
Okay, thank you. So I'm guessing that means you wouldn't be able to detect it yourself if you're in the space station.
No, I don't think so. I mean, small effects, but I think it does explain why. I think it's true that when they fire the little rockets that move the space station around a little bit, whether they're jogging out of the way of an incoming bit of space junk or whether they're just adjusting their orbit because it's been decaying, I think they switch off some of the more sensitive experiments that require microgravity because there is a significant acceleration at that point. So that's certainly measurable. Not sure whether the astronauts feel that. They might do. Not sure about that one, actually, but certainly they switch off the experiments.
Okay, thank you very much. Our final question comes from Twitter, from the user Malcontent. The universe is made up of mostly dark matter, which we cannot see. Is it possible the matter is actually held in black holes?
So I'm sure we've talked about dark matter on the Jogcast many, many, many times in the past.
I think once an episode, at least, yeah.
Okay, good. So we should, and it's appropriate, really, because dark matter is about five times the amount of the visible matter that we can see, so we should probably talk about dark matter more than we talk about normal matter. But yeah, the universe is, in terms of matter density, the universe is dominated by dark matter, and we don't know what it is yet. So the best, the most popular suggestions have been that it's some sort of particle physics explanation and a particle yet to be found. But there are other alternatives that have been discussed and you do see still being discussed. And one of them is, as Malcontent asks, maybe this dark matter is in black holes, and that's why we wouldn't see it. So the sorts of things that you would think about here, one thing is called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So this is basically how the elements are made in the Big Bang. And so there are very brilliant models, really. I mean, one of the great pieces of evidence for the Big Bang, I mean, we've got the expanding universe. So if the universe is expanding, you sort of wind the clock back, you get a Big Bang. You've got the cosmic microwave background that we see as well. That's another great piece of evidence. But one of the other classic pieces of evidence is you can do the nuclear physics calculations that tell you how the elements are built up in the early minutes after the Big Bang. So when you've got, you know, high densities, the particles are packed closely together. You've got high temperatures, so they're whizzing around very fast. And you can actually calculate the nuclear reaction rates that let you build up these lightest elements, the hydrogen, the helium, the deuterium, and so on. And actually the matter density, what's called the baryonic matter density, so that's the not sort of normal matter like protons and neutrons, etc. That's a key parameter for these calculations. And you can fit the predictions of those models, those Big Bang nuclear synthesis models, to observations of the abundances of these light elements. So how many of these elements we see in space, maybe in quasar absorption spectra or something like that. And it turns out that puts a limit on the density of baryonic matter, which is much lower than the dark matter density. So you can't explain away dark matter with so-called baryonic matter, even if it is dark. So like, you know, brown dwarfs, planets, very faint stars, even these sort of, you know, small black holes and things which might have been formed during the evolution of the universe over the 14 billion years since the Big Bang. You could ask whether there are black holes around that have been around from the beginning, actually, which is a different question, really, than black holes that evolved, were formed during the evolution of the universe, like in stellar evolution or something. We don't really understand where the supermassive black holes came from at the centres of galaxies.
Yep.
Okay. And, you know, they may well have formed early on. We know galaxies merge, and we know that supermassive black holes get bigger because of mergers, but we don't know perhaps when the original black holes formed. However, they're not a good candidate for dark matter because we know dark matter is distributed quite broadly. So if you look at like gravitational lensing experiments and so on, we can sort of make maps of where the dark matter is. And it's not as if it's concentrated just in the centres of galaxies, which is where these supermassive black holes are.
Yeah.
It's spread through the whole galaxy, so it can't be in the form of these supermassive black holes. You can sort of rule that out. But there is another possibility, which are things called primordial black holes, which could be like small black holes that are made right at the beginning of the universe at some point, and so they don't, you get round the nuclear synthesis solution by doing that, by forming them early enough. So Stephen Hawking, you know, came up with this idea of Hawking radiation from black holes, from the sort of event horizon of a black hole. And he worked out that radiation would basically lead very low mass primordial black holes to evaporate. So if you formed them at the beginning, they would have all evaporated by now if their masses were less than a million kilograms. Now, it's a bit hard, and I was actually just thinking, a million kilograms, what's a million kilograms? It's not hard to imagine. You could compare it to the mass of the sun. The sun is 2 times 10 to the 30.
Yeah.
So that's about 10 to the minus 18 times the mass of the sun.
Okay, so it's more comparable, smaller than the Earth, really, isn't it?
So it's smaller than the Earth, yeah. So in fact, this is my solution. I thought, I wonder what the volume of Loch Ness is. And this does, you know, the Loch Ness monster might be a particularly massive component of Loch Ness, but we'll ignore the Loch Ness monster, but just the water in Loch Ness apparently has a volume of 7.5 cubic kilometres.
Okay.
And if you turn that into a mass, a litre of water is a kilogram, then you get about 7.5 times 10 to the 12 kilograms. And Hawking ruled out these black holes with a mass less than 10 to the 12. So it's about the seventh the mass of Loch Ness. If that's any help. So we've ruled out Loch Ness-sized black holes, mass black holes. Of course, if they were black holes, their size would be tiny. If you turn the whole of the Earth mass into a black hole, it'd be about the size of a marble or something. So if you took the whole of Loch Ness water and turned it into a black hole, it'd be very tiny indeed. So these are sort of very microscopic black holes. Those would have evaporated, so it can't be that mass range. And people have been looking, you know, are the, you know, higher mass ones that might still be around? They use things like gravitational micro lensing. So this idea that you look at, you know, you look out through the halo of our galaxy and you can look at a star, and if a sort of one of these little black holes or something passes in front of the star, the light from the distant star is bent around it, and you actually get a sort of a focusing of the light. So actually the background star gets a bit brighter as something passes across the front of it. And that rules out quite a wide range of masses. There was a recent paper from using Kepler data, the transit telescope, that ruled out sort of things up to the sort of high end of what was possible, which was like getting on for the mass of the moon. So we were ruling out the sort of high end of that. And actually, the sort of lower end, so above Hawking's limit of Loch Ness size, Loch Ness mass things, up to, you know, the mass of several times the mass of a comet or something, that was actually recently ruled out by a study that showed that those type of primordial black holes would actually get trapped inside neutron stars.
Huh.
So if you imagine this sort of neutron star sitting there in space, and there's a sort of sea of dark matter made up of these primordial black holes, these tiny black holes, they would sort of collect in the inside. They would get trapped in the inside of a neutron star, and then if they get trapped inside, though, they just accrete the whole mass of the neutron star, and the neutron star disappears into the black hole. The fact that we see neutron stars in regions where we know there's dark matter from these broader lensing studies basically puts limits on how many of those primordial black holes that can be around, and there just isn't enough of them to explain this dark matter density. So it really does look like, for lots of different reasons, which I've, you know, skated over, I know, it really does look like we can't explain dark matter by hiding stuff inside black holes. And so we come back to the particle physicists, or we come back to fiddling our equations of gravity with like modified Newtonian dynamics or something, which changes the law of gravity to explain away the dark matter effects.
Well, it's a shame, but we've got to leave the particle physicists with something to do.
It's true.